Welcome to The Calm Down. My guests this week are the women of Feminist Folklore, our partner podcast at Skylark Media. From the Brothers Grimm to modern urban legends, each week Carly Hall Jensen and Rachel Marr consider what these stories can tell us about women's roles in different cultures and how they express society's beliefs about gender and sexuality. Today we'll be discussing different interpretations of the Hook Man tale, as well as the true crime stories of Lover's Lane, while we dissect the phenomenon of the teenage urban legend, our very own oral tradition. We've already covered the panic. Now, here's the calm down. All right, I am here with Rachel Marr and Carly Hall Jensen from Skylark Media's other podcast on the same network as American Hysteria, and that is Feminist Folklore. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Oh, hey there.
I'm so excited that you both came on. I'm a huge fan of Feminist Folklore, and I think there's so much that our shows do, even though your show is a talk-based, conversational show and mine's a scripted show. We still cover the same kind of cultural criticism, cultural studies, types of things that folklore and things like urban legends both represent. So I think today we're just going to be talking about kind of a little bit of the women's perspective of some of these stories, especially the Hook, urban legends in general, and just the stories that teens tell. So
yeah. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we love contemporary legends. Those are like our favorite. Carly and I just love telling those. So thanks for having us on.
Well, I feel like you're going to lend a certain expertise that I'm very excited about. And we were just talking before we started the actual recording here that my introduction to urban legends, especially The Hook and things like The Babysitter and the Man Upstairs and The Killer in the Back Seat, came from Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which is that fantastic series of books that came out when we were kids. And you all are in your early 30s, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
And I'm 30, so we're coming at this from a pretty similar frame of reference. So you both read Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark growing up, is that true?
Absolutely.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Favorite book. Terrifying illustrations. I still dream about those. They are so scary.
In that vein, we talk about in the episode, The Hook. That's the main legend that we talk about as a cautionary tale to young women who may engage in some necking / underage, you know, unmarried sex on a lover's lane in the 1950s. So you all have prepared some different versions of The Hook. I'm not sure how you want to present that, but we kind of wanted to look at some of the other ideas behind The Hook, aside from it just being this straight up cautionary tale, don't have sex, but about the symbology of The Hook itself and some of the nitty gritty points. So why don't you take it away, you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I love the versions. And actually, the one that I've heard is the most gross one, which I didn't realize that it was the most gross one. Like, I didn't know that there was one where she escaped. So there's other, you know, there's a million versions, but some of the ones that we pulled together is the one where the woman in the car, maybe I should back up just so that I give a full sense of what the Hook Man is. Basically, it's there's an escaped guy that from a nearby institution who is out on the prowl, and these two teenagers necking in a car. He happens upon them, but it's told from the couple's perspective, and usually, you know, the Hook Man reveals himself in some way. Another version is that the guy finds a flat tire, the boyfriend, and so he goes out to get help, and then the woman hears a drip on the car, and then she opens the door, she looks up, and her boyfriend is in a tree, and the blood is dripping on the car. Another version is that the woman falls asleep in the car when the boyfriend goes to get help because there's a flat tire, and then she wakes up to see this crazed Hook Man in front of the car, and the car is locked, thank goodness, but he holds up the head of her boyfriend and also the car keys, and then the story ends. So I think all of these versions are very, like, I remember that actually the one that I remember is seeing the boyfriend in the tree, and I don't know if it's because Scream came out, unclear.
Also, because that isn't an urban legend too? I think that one's an urban legend, or is it in I Know What You Did Last Summer?
Oh yeah. That's right.
It might be I Know What You Did Last Summer, because he's based on the Hook Man. I mean, he's got the hook.
Right.
You know? He's got the actual hook. Anyway, continue.
No, that's right. Yeah, I don't know why the version was floating around in the place in Maryland that I was, but it was always that he was hung up in a tree and the dripping was him. So those, yeah. Oh, we were both Maryland, so maybe it's just the area? Unclear.
In my research, it seems like those are kind of like they're a different legend. They're like a deviation, but a different legend. So there's the boyfriend's death, which is where he's hanging from the tree. And in some versions, it's the drip. In other versions, it's the scraping of his feet, right, on top of the roof.
Right,
and
right,
then she
right.
figures out what happens. But I guess I'm interested in how those two, that one is pretty different in a way from the other cautionary tale, because the person punished is the boy, you know, so what, how does that analysis change with the boyfriend's death and then with the hook man?
The boyfriend's death is a little bit more punitive in a way. But the thing that is interesting to me about that is also that the girlfriend is right in that version. She's like, don't go out there. Don't go out there. It's going to, you know, something bad's going to happen. And, she turns out to be correct. And she's the one who's kind of presenting this safer version of behavior, which feels kind of appropriate to me also, that like maybe because girls are socialized to think about their safety more, you know.
Well, in a way, it's like it's almost worse that the boyfriend gets punished because of the guilt of that for her, right? I mean, and it's also her that makes them stop because she's scared in the other hook, the version where the hook's hanging off the thing. So it's also like it falls squarely on the shoulders of the girl, right? Yeah. The responsibility, it seems like.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, on the one hand, like, that feels correct to me that young women often have to kind of carry the pressure of like being the one to mitigate men's behavior. Of course, we're all talking about in heterosexual scenarios, but not exclusively. You know, whether you're queer or not, you're still like responsible for shitty young men too. But you know, there's this this sense that young women are the ones who have to like say no, that boys are just going to do what they want. Boys will be boys. And I think that that feels like an accurate reflection of social pressure that is put on women, that like they're the ones who are responsible for making calls about safety, whereas young men are not expected to be responsible in that way.
Yeah, and I think that the urban legend kind of says, well, they should be, right? In some ways, like, hey, I don't know if that's what it's trying to get at, but I think if you read it from that perspective, you know, it's his fault he didn't take her seriously. You know, it's his fault that he wasn't thinking about safety. And I think that's kind of refreshing a little bit, because I don't know if anybody listens to the show, but it's very depressing because most of the time the women are the ones making the choices and getting the repercussions of those choices, right? And in this case, she makes a choice, he listens or doesn't, and he pays the price. And I think there's something there that is, it's a little refreshing. I mean, I think, like Carly's saying about the boys will be boys, you know, I think that there's a connection here with everybody should think about their safety. And I'm not sure that, I mean, I think sex is the catalyst here, which is unfortunate, because as you said in your episode, Chelsea, it's actually pretty counterproductive to have that as the core point of this. But, you know, I think thinking about everybody's safety in terms of sex even is a good thing, right? So, and he faces the consequences for that quite seriously.
You ever notice how finding time and energy to do the most basic human necessity, eat literal food, has become just another exhausting task jammed into our increasingly inhuman schedules? Well, your spring can be a little more stress-free with Factor. Factor will provide you with delicious, never frozen, ready to eat gourmet meals that are chef crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Each week, you get to choose from a menu of 35 options to create your perfect breakfast, lunch, or dinner with absolutely no prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. And Factor makes sure you get exactly what you want. You can tailor tailor deliveries to your schedule and customize how many meals you want each and every week. And you can pause anytime. So just head to factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 and use code AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code AmericanHysteria50 at factormeals.com/AmericanHysteria50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check out Factor today.
What that brings me to is this other interpretation that I brought into the episode that I know, I think it was Carly, you said that you have some questions about or your own sort of challenges too, which is that idea that Bill Ellis, the folklorist, came up with, that this hook-handed killer is actually a moral custodian or basically an authority figure that seeks to invade the private world of the teenager for their own whatever strange reasons they have for doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So, Carly, what is your response to that? Tell me.
Yeah. So I'm like very interested in the idea that you could kind of interpret this story as like a pro-sex or like a sex positive story where like, because Ellis is kind of saying like, actually the hook man is like a kind of negative or I think he like abnormal drive to interrupt like normal teenage behavior. And so like in that sense, then what the kids are doing necking in the woods alone is like normal and fine. And there's sort of this like terrifying interruption to it, which Ellis is conflating with the idea of like adults trying to prevent kids from doing what they're going to do anyway, which like I really love the idea that this is actually a story not about adults' anxiety about kids having sex, but about kids' anxiety about adults preventing them from having sex. Like, that's just delightful, I think. But I also, like, don't know if I fully buy that read. Like, I, when I start to, like, dig into it, it sort of falls apart for me in a way. Because, like, what happens when the hook man is prevented, right, is positive, right? Like, there's the hook man comes in and tries to disrupt, and it's terrifying, right? That he's a source of fear. But, like, what comes out of avoiding the hook man is a happy ending. I think it's a question of who's telling the story. Like, where does the circulation of that story come from? Is this kids telling the story about their anxieties, or is it adults telling it about their anxieties? And I think we tend to assume that it's adults, which the Dear Abby example that you read in the show, like, that suggests to me that that's probably an adult circulating that. I don't know. But it also, like, a lot of what these stories do is reinforce cultural control, right? Like, that's the whole purpose of a cautionary tale, is to say, like, do what the majority of us think is right. Like, don't stray from the path. And we talk a lot about this on the show, that, like, there are plenty of stories where, like, the quote-unquote moral of it is, like, stick to the status quo. Like, stick to what most people think is moral or correct. And I feel like if you read this story as a cautionary tale, it is very much a story about not, you know, it's a story about anxiety about not doing these things, you know, that teen sex is bad, and to be happy and survive, you have to not do those things. And so that Ellis's interpretation kind of feels in conflict with that reading of it to me.
And then I know, Rachel, you were mentioning another reading of it that's a little bit more... a little bit, let's say Freudian, shall we? Yeah,
yes.
Shall we? Do you want
to? It's definitely of the Freudian variety.
Yeah, tell me about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, well, there's this, I think it was, wait, Carly, help me say this, Dundas? Is that right?
I think it's Alan Dundas.
Alan Dundas says that the hook is actually a phallic symbol. And it's this idea that the hook man, you know, is like that he's missing an appendage, right? And so he stops sex from happening because he can't also have sex because it's an appendage. And so, I mean, I don't know that I buy that necessarily. But I do wonder, though, I mean, this is kind of a weird left turn, but we're going. So everybody hold on. You know, there's this there's a lot of talk, like, I don't know if you guys are into murders and ID
course,
channel and
yes.
stuff. Unfortunately, I am. And I know a lot of murders have taken place on Lover's Lane, like Zodiac killers, murders. Some of the Son of Sam stuff was also done on Lover's Lane. There was somebody in Texarkana that did a lot of Lover's Lane.
The Moonlight Murders. Moonlight,
that, yeah. Oh, yeah. So I think that there's, like, I think that the phallic symbol is very correct if you look at the actual perpetration, I can't say that word, but the actual perpetrators of these crimes, right? There was some sort of sexual component that they couldn't quite, you know, it wasn't actually, you know, they weren't able to do something sexually, so they took it out on these kids in these lovers' lanes. And I think that happens with at least, I only know the Zodiac Killer and the Son of Sam for sure. I think that that was one of the big reasons why they did it. And I wonder, too, how that rolls back into the actual contemporary legend, right? Like having an actual murder on a lover's lane, like how does that feed back into this sort of anxiety of sex and love and teenage love and young love and how that's not reliable and I don't know. I mean, I'm more postulating the question than answering yours, Chelsea, so I'm sorry, but
well, actually no, I mean, I'm really glad you brought that up because it was really hard for me to not include that part in the actual episode, just because it would have been a whole, like you said, it's kind of a left turn. Like, I'm such a true crime person that
yeah.
I wanted to talk about Texarkana, which did happen in the 40s, which was what you mm-hmm. were referencing. I will never know the motivations of that because that person was never caught. The Zodiac was never caught. But Son of Sam, we very much know that his motivation was basically the interpretation of the person who, like you said, the almost like the castrated male or whatever of a Freudian mm-hmm. a Freudian conversation who goes to kill these young people that he feels are engaging in what has not been given to him. You know, he was very much a red pill, you know, men's rights activist of that time. But I will say that Son of Sam came long after the legend had already begun. And so that's where I think those stories, and I think we talk about this in American Hysteria, where these things happen, these perfect crimes that encapsulate a moment in history and encapsulate the anxieties of the overculture, right? And I think that that's a good example, though, even though maybe it didn't cause the legend, it allowed the legend to continue to sort of snowball into holding different meanings, right? And so I don't think a legend is fixed in time, right? And so these things are going to influence its transformation.
When there's something in the water, so to speak, right? Like something in the cultural moment, it expresses itself in lots of different ways. So like it might express itself in an imaginary narrative or in a work of art, but it's also gonna like express itself in people's actions. And so like the idea that then like I'm always sort of skeptical of the idea that like there has to be a factual basis for a narrative, right? For a legend or for a fairy tale. People are really quick to like National Treasure things where they're like, yeah, this is based on something that actually happened. And like sometimes that's true. But also I think sometimes it's just like this is a real and a narrative expression. They sort of branched off in different ways. The idea that like someone in the 40s would be reacting to the same kind of cultural forces that you're talking about in the episode of like, you know, cars are available, the idea of the teenager is kind of coming to preeminence, that someone would see all of these things happening and see teenagers having increased sexual agency and respond to it with the same kind of anger that the story expresses seems very natural to me. Like, that makes a lot of sense as a kind of horrific, literal outcropping of the same kinds of cultural concerns that the narratives express.
Yeah. And I think, too, the way that the hook man is sort of given to us, right? The way that it's told to us is that even though the woman is right, she should be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something that we see through almost all the folklore we look at, right? Carly kind of mentioned it earlier that like it's the woman's job to be safe, which is why Carly and I tend to love the women that are just like, here to kill, because it's extremely refreshing. You know, like, they're not worried about their safety. They're going to come get you. And there is something there that is so different from what we expect from women. And I think there's a lot of, like, I know this isn't quite on the same, I guess, level as the Hook Man, but, you know, the babysitter and the man upstairs, that was based on a real case. A woman, I think in March of 1950, she was killed, and she was 13 years old. She wasn't even a woman. She's a little girl. March 18th, 1950, and she was killed. And then this sort of, like, rumor, you know, connected to that. And she did call the police. They couldn't trace it because it was prior to that technology. But there's so much there that, like, she's responsible for her safety. She needs to figure out how she can get help. And I think there's this underlying sort of sexist feel in general about these stories, about how women need to act. And, you know, we Carly and I talk about that a lot, and how problematic that is, but also it does serve to keep us safe. So, you know, in the case of the Hook Man, you know, the woman is safe. So it's this sort of problematic, or I guess problematic symbiotic relationship, right? Where you're still thinking about your safety, but you're recognizing that that's problematic. And I think the Hook Man is a very good example of that. And then, you know, the babysitter and the man upstairs is another good example about, I mean, there's also of other anxieties that we clearly have, right? Like you were saying, in the car, having this technology to get away from the parent. But I think too, in the babysitter, it's the technology of the phone and how it can't save you, right? Like there's some sort of anxiety there about we're moving too fast, things are happening too quickly, and it's not helping us, you know? So,
well, I'm throwing it back really quick to Satanic Panic. Mm-hmm. It's also to women leaving children in the hands of others.
True. Yeah.
Which is, again, another form of social control, right?
Love it.
Yay. Yeah. I think what you all said about social control and about the reinforcing of social norms is so much what I have discovered about our country and, of course, every country, every human nature, through doing American Hysteria, is that so much of the stories we tell and the symbols that we inherit and pass on have to do with the dominant culture's ideas of what, you know, are social norms and what those social norms need to be. And I think the biggest thing is, as our world changes, we need to continuously recognize that the stories we tell have to do with our social norms.
If I can say, too, I think one of the things that folklore is really about is saying, okay, what is the use of this, right? How does Satanic Panic, or how does a story about rainbow parties, like, how does that control people? But also, as like an expressive art form, how does it give voice to those anxieties? Because it is, I mean, it does have this social utility, but it also, like, if you look at those Satanic Panic stories as like an expression of a cultural moment, they're kind of beautiful and incredible and weird, and like, you couldn't make a movie that was weirder than that. You know, you couldn't invent something mm-hmm. that was stranger. And so I think we do something like, in looking at what the use is of things, we should also be looking at like, how do they help us articulate our anxieties about our cultural moment too.
What a beautiful way to end. I love that. That is absolutely perfect. So please, everyone listening, go listen to Feminist Folklore. You will not be disappointed. These two will make you laugh and make you think. And I know I love listening. So thank you both for talking to me. This has been really fun.
Thanks so much, Chelsea.
Looking forward to the next episode. Bye.
This was American Hysteria's The Calm Down. My guests this week were Carly Hall Jensen and Rachel Marr of Feminist Folklore. Make sure you subscribe to their show and follow Feminist Folklore on social media. And this episode was produced by Clear Camo Studios. We're taking a break next week, but join us in 2 weeks for our episode on American drug scares. And until then, y'all, just say no. Have a great couple weeks.